Welcome, teacher friend. I'm Lori.
And I'm Melissa.
We are two literacy educators in Baltimore. We want the best for all kids, and we know you do too.
Our district recently adopted a new literacy curriculum, which meant a lot of change for everyone. Lori and I can't wait to keep learning about literacy with you today.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Literacy Podcast. Melissa and Lori love literacy. We are very excited for today's guest because he's an educational consultant extraordinaire is how I'm going to describe him. Melissa, would you agree?
Absolutely. Yep. I've called on Mitchell a few times to just lend us his expertise. So I think that's a great way to put it. He's just a pretty amazing educator.
Yeah. I feel like when we introduce guests, it must be really fun, like for the guests to sit there and be like, here's all these cool things about this person. So Mitchell, do you feel really special right now? How are you feeling? Welcome to the podcast.
I can honestly say I'm really, really, really excited about today because you all should know this. This is the first podcast I've ever done.
Ooh. Welcome.
All right. And you've got your bookshelf background for us. We're all ready. We're psyched for the podcast.
It's going to be
welcome.
Great.
You know what? Most people say that after they podcast with us, they've had a great time. So we hope that you have the same experience. We aim to please.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Mitchell.
So I should start here, because I think this is probably the part that hopefully people connect with. I grew up in a household where my mother nurtured my love for education. Mm. And how did she do that? She allowed me to turn my bedroom into a classroom. She would take me to the store and I could buy like the things to decorate the walls, got teacher edition books.
Oh, that's so funny.
Computer grade book software program. So I grew up and all my cousins grew up. When they came over to my house, they actually had to play school. And I was serious about it. I can go back to times of being like age of like 11, where I would take my teacher edition book and I would have my lesson plan book and just like start writing out like, what would I do if I was a teacher? So
I really
pay homage to my mother because she took my passion and she took the gifts and the calling on my life seriously and just allowed me, you know, to play first.
Yeah.
And then that moved into when I was age 14, my Sunday school superintendent and vacation Bible school superintendent pulled me to the side and said, Mitchell, you have to teach vacation Bible school. I was 14 years at the time. And I was like, oh my goodness, I'm going to finally do what I've been playing in my bedroom for all these years. And because at that time, I did not know what like age group or anything like that. And it was that experience in the church where I fell in love with elementary education. And that took me on to get my bachelor's degree in elementary ed. I started as a third grade teacher on the south side of Chicago, Hyde Park.
Aww.
And that was an awesome experience because then my principal saw something in me at that time. And even the district leaders came into my class, and I'll never forget this. They looked at my bulletin board and the district leaders pulled me to the side and said, you're a writing teacher. And I didn't know what that meant. First-year teacher. But I knew I felt affirmed. Mm. And as a Black male educator, I was the youngest in my school. That was like the impetus for me saying, I want to learn more about literacy. I want to make sure that children become literate citizens that critically think and use these literacy processes to transform their lives and those around them. So that just was my impetus to learn more and more, because then I moved into teaching fifth and sixth grade. I taught gifted ELA. I've taught pull out for first grade, all those various things. And I said that wasn't enough. And I said at that time, I think I was at my fifth year of teaching, I wanted something more. And so I decided to go for achieving National Board certification.
Nice.
Because that is nothing short of a feat while you're teaching.
I did that too, and it is not easy.
I came back, and I remember telling my class, I was teaching sixth grade at the time, I said, I'm going for National Board Certification. They said, what is it? And I said, well, is this certification like it's like the highest certification you can get as a teacher? It shows that you're like, you demonstrate proficiency, all this type of thing. And they were more excited about the process than I was. And so they helped plan and figured out like what we should do in the videos. And That's so cool. A beautiful experience. And in 2009, I achieved National Board Certification in Literacy.
Congratulations.
Ooh, congrats. Yeah. I bet you remember how that felt still today. Uh-huh. Like I could see it on your face. You're like, yeah, that was a lot.
That was, you know, I think the power of it was, again, as teachers, you just needed that affirmation moment.
Yeah.
And it was in that moment, I remember it was right before Thanksgiving, and I got that email and it said, you certified. I felt affirmed that what I had been doing since I was in my bedroom as a child
was
true. And that it made an impact. And so from that National Board Certification experience, that pushed me. That same year, I went to the International, at that time, I think it was called the International Reading Association. At that time, they were having the yearly conference in Chicago. And I remember sitting back at the conference. It was like over 100 something people. And I looked up at the presenters and they were two white women. And something in that moment said, one day it'll be me. Mm. In 2010, I decided to leave the classroom because I felt called that I was supposed to be someone that was going to be a change agent, that was going to be a champion for teachers. Mm-hmm. And I left at that time, became a district leader of RTI, then moved into being a district leader of literacy over 30 schools. And I said, that wasn't enough. And what did I do? I went right back into the schoolhouse and became a school administrator. And for the past 7 years, I have been a school administrator in the South Side of Chicago. I moved to New Orleans and had the opportunity to work with amazing educators here. I've had the opportunity to truly be a part of turnaround processes. And one of the things that I'm so proud of is that every school that I work with, we had double digit gains in literacy and math. And I don't take that as what I did. I take it as it was the strength of the teachers and it was the work ethic of the students that I served. Mm-hmm. And setting the expectations for high achievement. And now I transition out of the schoolhouse of the school administration. Now I'm in educational consultancy, where I am the program director, one of the program directors of Leading Educators, and my project is Baltimore City Schools.
Hey.
And along with that, I have the honor and privilege to being on the Reading League board. I have the honor and privilege of still mentoring people who want to achieve National Board Certification. Nice. I have the honor and privilege to facilitate and design for Unbound Ed. And just a whole just different opportunities that have just opened up. And again, it just takes me back to just being grateful for the early beginnings of the calling on my life that I'm a change agent. And so that's why I'm here today, because there's more work to be done that I'm passionate about. I'm passionate about literacy. And so I'm ready to jump into today's conversation because this is a need.
Yeah. And I mean, your passion is just amazing, Mitchell. And I think like this is another way that you're going to get your voice out there and people are going to hear from you. So
yeah,
we're excited to share.
Well, and it's, I feel like Mitchell, just from that intro, which is nothing short of amazing, we could talk about like 30 different topics, right? Like we could, so I bet everybody's on the edge of their seat. Our literacy like, lovers out there are thinking, today? What are they going to talk about today?
Yeah. So I'll jump in there. So I saw an article that was not written by Mitchell. I'll put that out there, but it was an article about, it was called Teaching Reading to African-American Children When Home and School Language Differ by the amazing Julie Washington. I have a little bit of a like work crush on Julie Washington. Don't tell her.
Melissa emailed her. We're going to send her I'm going to directly inbox her this episode because Melissa emailed her to be on the podcast as a compliment to you, Mitchell. And not this one, but another one to talk about the article. So we hope that she will come on because like Melissa was like nervous to type the email. That's how much she adores
her. A little. But also Mark Seidenberg, who's also amazing. Not to downplay Mark Seidenberg too. But anyway, I read this article.
Mark Seidenberg too, yeah.
Yeah. I read this article. I was like, this is such a great article to talk about, especially, you know, in Baltimore, most of the students I taught were African-American. So I've always had this kind of, this was always in my head a little bit, like what's going on with my students and when we're teaching them to read, what's happening there. But then Mitchell, I saw you posted on a Facebook group that Lori and I are both in about the science of reading about this same article, like right when I had read it and I was excited about it. And I was like, oh, I know Mitchell. Let's talk to Mitchell. And you started a really great conversation with the teachers in that Facebook group. So that's why I wanted to bring you on to have this conversation.
Yeah.
Oh, here we are. So Mitchell,
I thought Mitchell's post was interesting because Mitchell, you're very eloquent and it really did spark curiosity. So I'm wondering if it might make sense now for Melissa, can you share a little bit about the post and like what attracted you to it? And then Mitchell, I'd love for you to share a little bit about your thoughts behind the article and how you crafted that, you know, post or even how you crafted the conversation around it to make it really incredibly insightful for everyone who was participating in it. I just think your voices both should be elevated on this.
Yeah. I'm just going to push it over to Mitchell though. I'll come back in later, but I want to hear from Mitchell. Like what made you want to post that? And how did you feel about what you posted?
The reason why I posted it, because I'm really a proponent of culturally relevant pedagogy. And if you know who a seminal writer of that, you would know it's Gloria Lansing Billings. Mm-hmm. And everyone talks about being culturally relevant and what that is. But yet we still have this ambiguity of what does that look like in the classroom? How do you do it in a very concrete way? And mm-hmm. when I read her work, this piece by Washington and Seidenberg, I had this aha moment of this is a very explicit way that brings to the table what culturally relevant pedagogy could look like. Mm-hmm. Especially in a time and place where we're talking about the science of reading and the focus has moved towards how do we use evidence-based practices to really build children's word recognition skills and their language comprehension. This particular piece resonated because it does that. Even more,
yeah.
I would say what was really powerful to me as well was that if we're going to be honest, when we look at the national reading results, let's be clear that there's a subgroup of students who literally are struggling the most, who have been, as I would say, minoritized, have been at the brunt of academic disparity. And we're not just talking for 5 years, we're talking for over 200 years. And this particular post really illuminated for me, like, you know what? If we wanted to solve this issue, if we wanted to contribute to what we call closing the opportunity gap, this could be a way of doing that.
That's a good point. What did you read in that article that made you think that? Like that made you think this could be a way? Are there any tangible things you can share with our listeners who might be able to either like have things like that resonate with them right now, or they could read the article because I'll link it and then they can think about how they can apply this in their practice as well. But I think your thoughts on it are really welcome.
So in the particular article, what they do, and I think it was just great to have it, they took all of this research around African-American English, created this table that literally spelled out for you that, yes, these are the features of African-American English that makes it distinct from other languages. So you got to think about morphology, syntax, and phonology. And when you saw it very clearly, for example, you see it very clearly in that table that in African-American English, there is like a consonant cluster reduction. Those final consonant sounds can be reduced at the end. And it was like, wow, we've been doing all this talk about, you know, let's, for example, phoneme grapheme mapping. Mm-hmm. And how to teach children how to map sounds to print. What does it look like to literally say, okay, if I'm interacting with a student who has, you know, high density of African-American English, how do I literally call to their attention the differences between African-American English and general academic English in the setting of teaching decoding and encoding? And I think that table truly just showed that, wow, so if they are, you know, deleting, you know, final sounds, I could literally create an instructional sequence that highlights that aspect and show them the differences between that. Hopefully they might become masters of both dialects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to like do a quick scan across and give an example of the table that you're talking about, the key features of African-American English. Can I do a quick little scan across? Melissa, were you going to say something that you
no,
wanted
go ahead.
To get
you
in
do
before
that
I did that?
Nope, you go okay. first.
So Mitchell is talking about the table that is featured in the article, and it's titled Key Features of African-American English. There are different topics here. So we're talking about verb morphology, syntax, phonology, and then we describe each one and then give specific examples of it. So for example, in verb morphology, the variable past tense, this is described as the ED marker is variably attached to verb forms in past tense contexts. And an example could be the cow jump over the moon. He fix the broken car. So leaving that ED off could be a variable in as a key feature of African-American English. I want to make sure I got that right. Was that right?
Perfect.
Okay. That's how I was understanding it. And that's how you explained it. So I just wanted to make sure. So
another example.
Yeah. Go ahead.
To make it more clear, you know, when you're working with students who use African-American English, they may use terms like, you know, jumping and things like that. And so you don't hear the G at the end. Mm-hmm. It's that J-U-M-P-I-N. And so that's a common feature. And so mm-hmm. I thought that was really important that was highlighted, because now you understand where it comes from. But the other piece that was just really affirming about this chart that we don't always talk about is that we've shamed African-American English. We've made it seem like it's not a real language. It's not mm-hmm. governed by rules. There's no sense to it. And now we have a chart like this that says, no, all those things that you were told that were based in biases and stereotypes are lies. They are wrong. African-American English does have rules. Mm-hmm. And there's patterns to it. And there are common features of it that affirm that it is true. And so yep. that table itself, just for me, and I'm grateful for it, because it speaks back to all those lies of saying that our language is substandard, our language is inferior, our language does not exist, it's made up. But yet it has all of these various rules, just like all the other dialects that yep. are present.
Yeah. Language variation impacts that, right? Impacts reading, spelling, and writing, and in predictable ways. That's what the article says, and that's what you're speaking to. Sorry, Melissa. I feel like I keep accidentally
you
talking
keep me out
and
today.
No. Not seeing your mouth move. I'm sorry. On the screen.
I was just going to say that's what I am.
You know I love you.
I was going to bring that up earlier. Was that when I was in my master's program, which we often like kind of say we didn't learn so much in my master's program. Yeah. Poo-poo was exactly the word I had in my head, but I didn't want to say it. but I did learn in a literacy course, and it was, or not literacy, linguistics course. It was straight linguistics, not for educators necessarily, but that was the first time I learned about African-American English as what you just described it, Mitchell, as like, it has rules. And like, I think of the way it's described in the article is like a rule governed variety of English agreed upon and used by a community of speakers. And that it blew my mind. But I remember, I think I did an extra project about it. Like it wasn't exactly like, it was like something we learned about for like 5 minutes. And then I decided I wanted to learn more about it in that class. But I think what you said is right, because I think not only is it like not seen as a language, I think it's seen as like, what I hear more often is that it's wrong, right? Like if you're not pronouncing that ing on the end of jumping, you're saying it wrong. And like you're saying, like, what does that do to a student who's coming in saying, well, that's the language I hear, right? Like that's what I hear at home. That's what I hear everyone around me. So that's how they all say it. But then I come here and you're telling me it's wrong, right? Like, I just can't, like, I mean, I can't put myself in those shoes, but I can imagine that like that, what does that do to a student? And as they're trying to learn the language, like what
build their identity, build their identity as a self and as
confidence.
A learner.
I think what's interesting about what you're saying is it destroys their identity.
I would imagine it would.
It ensures that when I step into your classroom, I'm always going to be deemed inferior.
Right.
Right.
It ensures that. And we don't realize the casualties, the blood that is shed by the words that we use with our children and those implicit messages that we're teaching them. Mm-hmm. You've not only ensured that they have a lack of self, you know, efficacy, but you've also made them look at their community from a deficit lens as well.
Mm-hmm.
So now when I'm in school,
that's a good point.
Now when I'm in school, I now look at my African American community as we are uneducated. And we don't know how to communicate, and we don't know how to write, and we don't know how to think. So you didn't just tear me down. You've also just tear down the way I view my own family, my friends, and my community.
Right. So my question has always been like, so what do you do, right? Because the tests that they have to take and everything that our students see is going to be in this general American English, right? Versus most of the written language that they see will not be in African American English. So how do we, I think the article speaks to this pretty well, is like, how do you actually bring those two things together versus just saying, that's wrong, this is right, learn the right way, forget about the way you speak at home. Like, how do we actually bridge those two?
I think the first step for me is we need to increase the capacity and the knowledge of teachers around this language variant, right?
For sure.
We've got to make sure you understand that. And so when we talk about culturally relevant pedagogy, this is now the time to say, when we say that in this particular lens, this is the knowledge you need to have. Because this knowledge will guide even how you assess students.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in my journey of learning about this, it was really clear to me that even how we assess phonemic awareness, there are certain tasks that we give for phonemic awareness tests that African-American students who use this dialect are going to get dinged for.
Right.
Are now going to be labeled as they are disabled or they have a learning disability or whatever that is, all because you're not aware that in actuality, it's not a learning disability. It's a language variant. And so that comes into like how we assess. So we actually, like I think about assessment, we need to understand what are the commonalities and the key features of African-American English so that when we assess children, we can know if it's in the norm or not. I think that would definitely help us. And then I think the knowledge piece around understanding very clearly how this variant can get in the way of them becoming proficient in reading and writing.
Right.
So if you understand that having a high density of African-American English can slow reading growth, and it slows it this way, and it can slow spelling growth, and it slows it this way, you can then create an instructional plan. So I definitely think like the understanding of assessment, the understanding of the impact, the understanding of the language itself and the rules that govern it are crucial to then getting to the place where, how do you design an instructional sequence? And that was like more the impetus for my post in the Facebook group, and shout out to the Facebook group because I'm one of the moderators and got it. And a lot of great work, great people are part of that. But at that same time, I was really learning and studying phoneme, grapheme, mapping activities. Mm-hmm. And I said, wow. So now that I have this knowledge of all these three things, how can I use something like phoneme, grapheme, mapping, that instructional sequence, to actually teach children what I call a formal way of code switching? So teaching them, these are the rules that govern, you know, GAE. These are the rules that govern AAE. And when I give the word like with, I can then ask you, well, how many phonemes are in that particular word? And then I can say, now, when it's time to spell it out, can you spell it out for me in AAE? Can you spell it for me in GAE? And then I can ask the child to then take the next step and say, okay, take your pen or whatever, or marker, and circle the differences. Because the piece about code switching is that we have to train the child's eye to actually notice the distinct differences. And so when that child sees that, oh, in GAE is TH, but in AAE, it can be an F. And we can have that conversation about why it is so, right? And so I think that is just one instructional routine that we can use with students, or phoneme, grapheme, mapping, or we can do things like when we do, you know, PA phoneme. How are we, I would say, making them more conscious of the distinct differences in the phonology of words?
Yeah. That's what I was looking at, the example they give in the article, which helped me, because it says, like, deciding that cold and whole do not end in the same sound may be difficult if cold is usually pronounced coal, right? So I was just like, that's such a simple example, but it, I mean, huge, right? And it, like, if the student doesn't get that, you might just say they don't understand the D sound, right? Or they don't understand, or they're not getting the ending sounds, right? You just like put them in a whole category of like, they're not getting it, versus if they recognize, oh, that's part of this variety of English that they're speaking, then like what you said, Mitchell, is like, they can actually point out the difference versus just like, again, like they're not getting it, right? Or putting them in a small group to review it. But like, it might not be helpful to just keep reviewing it if they, you know,
I think that you're teaching building knowledge and also with curiosity, which I think honors the students, what they're bringing to the table, but it also helps the teacher understand like there are two differences, but it honors the student's difference. So it still allows the student to know both, and it honors what they're bringing as well. So I feel like those are like my two thoughts on it. Like, it's building knowledge on both ends, right? For the teacher, and then also helping the student build their knowledge, because if they can see the difference, of course they're going to be able to hear those letter sounds if they are asked to hear them, or are it's given to them as different options. Like, I think that's what stood out to me, like those options, like what does like GAE versus AAE, this word, the same word, and the student can be reflective about that and then have an opportunity to try it out themselves. But it's not because one is right and one is wrong. It's because this practice of getting curious about, well, which sound do I hear? What makes this sound? And one I'm hearing and one I'm maybe saying, right? Like, so I think there's different ways to approach this, but I think the students are, if they're curious and we're building their knowledge about it, then those are really ways to honor them in this practice. Is that like, are you thinking, Mitchell, that that would be like an accurate interpretation? Cause I either want to like keep that in my brain or rewire what I just spewed out to you.
Well, I think what you're actually saying makes a whole lot of sense. I have two points on that, because the first point is, and I think Melissa touched on it, and it was this idea of like, as a teacher, when you see that the child is, in your words, making an error, you then put them in this category, right? I need to work on this particular sound, blah, 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 blah. We all know what that means. But what the studies are showing is that in actuality, it's not that the student who speaks with AAE has a deficit in phonemic awareness. Many times it's the connection or the interconnectedness between their phonology and their orthographic knowledge. It's about the spelling piece of it that they need to really hone for that moment. And so if you understand the variance, you won't, what I would say, commit malpractice and literally start, you know, intervening in such a way that's not really even solving the issue. And the other piece that you're bringing up that's really powerful is like, and you said that word, options. I think that is so critical, because when we think about what is code switching, right? Code switching is someone's ability to navigate like two or more distinct communities. Mm-hmm. They can navigate those two contexts or more than one context, right? And you get to reap the benefits of being a part of both.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right? So when I think about the options, you're actually giving the child agency.
Yeah.
That I can be proud that I am Black while also learning another dialect and how to spell. And I don't have to strip away my identity because I need to learn a new, you know, a new orthographic pattern. And I think that's really something that's missing in classrooms for Black students, because we often feel like we need to assimilate. Mm-hmm. And in those moments, and that's why I say that activity of, I want you to write in AAE and I want you to write in GAE, because I want you to be masters of both. Because there's a strength in being, you know, bi-dialectical, right? There's a strength in that versus the deficit mindset that we have instilled in educators.
That and what's wrong?
No, we actually act like being bilingual is a deficit. Mm-hmm. Like you're getting in the way of it versus like, I would actually think that if you can navigate two dialects or two languages, that's a demonstration of advanced literacy proficiency.
Yep. I was going to say, I think we see that a bit. I've seen it at least a bit more with English learners, right? Like students who are speaking Spanish, for example, learning English. I think there feels like there's a bit more compassion and a bit more of what you were just saying of like, yeah, it'll be great that you know two languages, right? That'll be a benefit for you in the long run. But I can't say that I've seen that with African American English in my experience. I haven't seen many people speak about African American English in the same way of like, you know, mastering these two varieties of English is a benefit. I just haven't seen that in practice very much.
I think it's interesting that you say that, because I would agree. I don't think that Black children are given the same grace.
I agree.
I'm wondering too if it's because of teacher knowledge. Do you know what I mean? Like, how many? If we had,
Mitchell's
if we,
like kind of partly, but
I mean other things too. But I mean, if we surveyed, I'm curious. That's probably part. Like as with everything, there's many parts to a problem, but. What are you thinking?
I think there is a piece of teacher knowledge, but I also have to go back to the anti-literacy laws. You never taught us and never wanted us to be literate. Mm-hmm. So we do have to figure out a way of how to communicate And so because we had to figure out a way of communicate, you don't even want to acknowledge the fact that the intelligence that it took to create a dialect, to create a means of communication, and actually doing it in such a way that allows us to still to stand today. Because we have a lot of examples of African-American people who learned to code switch. And they have reaped the benefits of both. And it's interesting how we are still in a place where we are acting as if having, being able to move in those two terrains is a problem. And I think we can also say that to a degree it is a problem because we shouldn't have to, right? There should be some inclusion piece of this, but I do feel like overall that, yes, a part of the issue that Black children are not given the same grace that is due to racism. Another part of the issue is due to structural issues. There's another part of the issue that's due to language. And I will say this, like you just said, knowledge of teacher. But then I would also push back and say, Why do teachers not know this? What's the root cause of them not learning it? And I'm not gonna and if we're gonna consistently say, well, because they didn't learn it in college, no, because of racism. You didn't want the variant to be taught. You didn't want the variant to be seen at the same levels other languages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm thinking of like Mitchell, we didn't talk about this, so I don't know if you know much about it or not. I won't assume, but I'm thinking of, I don't know much about it, but the in Oakland, I think it was in like the late 80s when they were pushing to have, I mean, it was termed Ebonics then, I believe. But the push was very similar, I think, to what we've been talking about today, right? Of like recognizing African-American English in the schools. And I mean, if you look it up now, like it's just, it was controversial. It was very controversial, right? And I think it's what you're saying is like people didn't necessarily embrace it. They pushed back against it. And
we didn't embrace it. And, you know, which is also uncomfortable to talk about as well. Even in my own community, we didn't embrace it because of internalized racism. We've always been taught that the way that we speak, until you can speak white, until you can speak proper English. And if you can't do that, you're not deemed to be educated. You're not deemed to have intellect. So that's that is a piece that we never allow African American English to have its place as a viable, a real, governed by rules dialect. We haven't done that. And so I think there's a place in our conversation now of how do we utilize this information so that we don't have the slow growth of reading and writing? Mm-hmm. How do we understand it in such a way that we can now use students' funds of knowledge to then build the connection between this new variant that they have to learn?
Right. Mitchell, do you know of any schools or districts or teachers alone who are tackling this?
I don't know any schools that's tackling it from a very formal way. Mm-hmm. I find that when this conversation comes up, and it's nothing against anyone who does this, but it's this, we should accept children's home language. We should embrace it and we should affirm it so that it can be in the classroom and they can feel comfortable, right?
Right.
And I totally agree with that move. What I'm pushing for is, no, let's do more than that. Because they have to see the distinct differences between their language and others. Mm-hmm. So that they can actually reap the benefits of being able to navigate multiple contexts.
Well, I feel like it's like anything. If you don't teach them how to do that, they're not going to be able to do that. Right. So if we don't teach kids how to either hear that they're saying the G on the end of the word or not hear it and then give them words to put, you know, general American English or African American English, then, and give them the words for that. Like, this is what I'm doing. Like, metacognitively, this is what I'm doing. And help them to be able to, like you said earlier, empower them to choose. How are they going to know?
I mean, it comes
unless back, they're taught.
It comes back to our rallying cry in SOAR, right? We believe in explicit, systematic, cumulative instruction. We believe in being direct. Mm-hmm. Why is it that this has become an issue that it's not being done that way? And I think we need to ask ourselves that question. I totally agree that it needs to be explicit, because what if the results, what if some of the results, I'm not going to say the preponderance of results are linked to this, but what if some of the failure rate that we're seeing in African-American children is correlated to the fact that we have not engaged them in systematic, explicit instruction in code switching? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What if that's possible?
Yeah.
In the spirit of like leaning into discomfort in this, can I ask you a question? Do you notice that, like, because I'm curious about the dynamic, right? I'm just curious. Like, this is playing in my head as you're sharing. If there's an African American teacher and an African American student, do you notice that the switching is encouraged more or taught more? Or, like, I'm just curious if that might be in the nature of the dialect of the teacher, then does it more times get to the student as an option?
I think when you can code switch, just like how we think about, we know the impact of like oral language development, right? We know that if we are, you know, engaging kids in oral conversation, they can pick up on language structures and vocabulary. I think the same thing can happen when you have an African-American teacher who knows how to code switch. The child will be immersed in an environment that allows them to do that. And I think we also have studies that show that, yeah, African-American students who possibly live in homes where code switching is a norm, they have more facility with it. But what about the children who don't? And to answer your
question, it's like utility, right? Yeah.
And answer your question more specifically is that if I'm the African-American teacher who don't even understand the rules that govern my own African-American dialect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know how, and let's keep it honest, because if we're saying that a lot of teachers have not even been trained in the language structures of English.
Right. That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Do you really think that we have this preponderance of group of educators who understand the language structures of African-American English and can teach it explicitly and directly and cumulatively?
Right. Even if it is the variety of English that they may speak at home themselves, right? They might not still be aware of.
Because here's the thing. We speak the language, but how many of us taking the time to say, okay, let me codify this for myself. What are we actually doing? Right? And then how many of us, I speak as an African American, like I'm not even sure how I learned how to code switch. I think, you know, I go back to my experiences when my mother, I remember we moved to the suburbs and I was one out of three Black children in a whole white classroom. And I had to survive.
Right.
And I quickly learned that I was inferior to the whole class. And something within me said, like, I had this, it was like, I do not want to feel like this way. I have to be competitive. I have to be like them, right? And so I remember trying to learn the various things that I was seeing all the white children in my class do. And I'll be honest with you, what if I learned it because I was a part of the 40% of students that would naturally pick it up?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, what if I'm that reader? Because we look at the studies that show that, yeah, about 40% of kids will learn to read because they're just immersed in it. But the other 60% need systematic explicit instruction.
Right.
What if I just picked it up? What if I was the student who never saw those connections?
Mm-hmm.
Where would I be? So I'm passionate about this topic because this could be an opportunity for more research to show how do we engage children in specific instructional routines that they'll learn how to code switch
earlier.
And we're not, you know, and my plea to the SOAR community, just as much as children with dyslexia are a rallying cry and are important, just as much as we say that subgroup of students need explicit instruction, just as much as we say that the bilingual students, our English language learners, need explicit instruction, just as much as we say children with exceptional needs need explicit instruction, don't forget about the 80% of Black children who are not proficient readers.
Right.
Maybe they need it as well. And maybe they need it because of the structural elements that we have put into place consistently that have barred them from their own liberation.
Yeah. I've always had this thought about Baltimore, and you know, I know nothing about K-2, so don't hold me to any of this, but
you know a little bit.
I know a little bit. But you know, we've had foundations for years in Baltimore, right? So we've had systemic or, you know, explicit phonics instruction happening. I'm not going to say there's not necessarily, you know, that it's perfect, but it's happening. But you know, I don't know the numbers, Lori, but I think that 80% mark is probably right of students who are not meeting what they need to in foundations through K-1 and 2, right? And we see that just kind of snowball right over the years, right? They don't meet the marks in phonemic awareness and phonics and then fluency and then comprehension. And, you know, it just kind of snowballs. And I've always just wondered, I guess, this question of like, is there just maybe like a different way to do it for African-American students that might be in addition to a foundations, right? In addition to that systematic phonics, is there something else that needs to happen? And like, maybe like you're saying, Mitchell, like maybe something like this is what we need to try.
Such a convoluted issue, complex issue, right?
I know, because there's so many things that I want to say. Like, I'm like, just, oh, go ahead. There's so many things rolling around in my head right now, Mitchell, that I can't wait to hear what you're going to say so that I can like make sense of what's in my head.
I think to address, and if I'm hearing you correctly, please tell me if I'm not. Let's also understand that these curriculums that we are choosing do not have African-American dialect at the forefront.
For sure.
So it's
probably not at all.
Right. I mean, that's not a, because the thing about it is this, we, as I'm looking at curriculums and I'm part of different boards, I can see like, they'll say, you know, look at this curriculum and analyze, are there English language supports, right? But then you ask yourself, so where's the call out for AAE? And so I do wonder, are we not seeing traction? Because again, we're consistently choosing curriculums that are made for white children. And then you're wondering why it's not working. Yes, we all learn to read similarly, right? We know that the eyes and the brain are processing sounds and building, you know, syntactical knowledge and orthographic knowledge. We all know that. But when you have a language variant, your approach, your learning path to mastery is probably going to be a lot longer and need a lot more, you know, ample, intensive practice. And I do wonder if we're not seeing the results because we're unaware of these types of things. Yeah. Laura, you want to say something?
No, I just feel like you said it really well. I just think there are so many variables in this, right? We can't measure the extent to which teachers are using a systematic program systematically. Or it's really challenging to measure that. We know that there's not something in place to address AAE. So that's a variable that we can see. We also don't know, you know, I think it depends on the grade level that we're coming in at. Like, there's just a lot of questions I would have. Like, if we were talking about students in a third grade classroom, it'd be a different conversation than a kinder classroom. Like, what have they received before? Where are they lacking? If we're coming in as kinders, what do they know so far? But I don't even know that that's a relevant question. I'm kind of spinning because I feel like there are so many questions to ask about this, but you're right. It's because of all the variables. So I'm just thinking, like, what I'm going to take away from this conversation is how can we, like, keep that in the forefront? Like, how can we make better what we have while also including what we are thinking we might need to include? Like, I'm just wondering how this could play out. And I'm just going to keep that rolling. And we're going to check back in with you at some point to hear more.
So I'm going to kind of cut us off, Mitchell. I'm not going to lie. And I hate to cut you off.
We could keep going.
But then we'll have a 2-hour-long episode.
Yeah.
And you know, we're no
also, we will have stolen too much of Mitchell's time. Yeah.
Yes. So I am going to ask if you would share with us a piece of advice, which you've given a lot, but just one thing you want to leave our guests with. And I don't know if Lori has her fun questions for us.
Because
don't see your cards. Oh, there they are. Okay. So she might have a question for you too.
I will find a question for you after you do advice. Okay.
Perfect.
You just think of your advice, Mitchell, and you give it. And I will give you two choices for a really fun little way to exit this podcast.
I'm going to leave with my motto. The function of education is to teach one to think intensively and to think critically. I think we're at a time and place where intensively, that means laying aside every weight and thinking about the task at hand, thinking about what our children need. And then critically, that whole point of, is it working? Is there an alternative path? Is there something else need to be added to what we're doing? I think that is important. So, you know, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's advice, I'm just giving it to you all as well.
I'm glad you got your favorite quote in.
Couldn't let you exit without that. Thank you for that reminder. All right, are we ready for our fun ready. Trivia question for you? We didn't tell Mitchell this was happening.
Mitchell's
totally
face
shocked.
Doesn't look like he's like, I don't know about this. You guys didn't tell me. What did I sign up for?
He's like, I'm not quite sure I trust you. All right. I've got two options for you. You can choose. It's this really fun little deck I found for podcasters. It's called Pod Deck Ideas. And so it's like you draw a card and then ask a question. So I'm going to ask you to answer one of these two. I'd like you to either share a new skill that you're learning or really cool stuff that you're using lately, like apps, products, services, anything that you think is really cool to share. It could be education related or not. This is just you, Mitchell.
when you're thinking to yourself, should I really share the new skill I've learned in the past year? I don't know if this is the right place for that.
Well, I mean, I'm hoping you're like, I'm becoming a singer and you're going to jam out or something awesome mm-hmm. for us. But no you pressure. Tell us what your new skill is. Yeah, no pressure.
Why do I always think of like woodworking? I don't know why that was always my
your face is cracking me up. I'm like, what is it? Now I'm so curious.
Anybody who knows me, the new skill that I've been really excited about in the past year is that I became a certified bartender. And so loving the idea of making people feel good, making them try new experiences.
Libations, that's so cool.
Libations are fun. So that would be in the past year, I've been perfecting that.
Oh my gosh. I love that. That wasn't for all the faces. That's a brilliant skill. Congratulations.
Yeah, that's really cool. Plus you're in New Orleans. That's like the place to do it, right?
Place to do it.
Oh my gosh. Awesome. Well, next time, you know what we should do? We should podcast again and you can send us a drink recipe that you feel like would be delicious for podcasting. And we can podcast and drink.
It might get real silly by the end.
Mitchell's signature beverage. I like this.
Well, it was so great to have you, Mitchell. I mean, you pushed my thinking today, so I really appreciate it. So I hope we get the same response from some of our listeners.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And thank you for just everything that you're doing to elevate this from posting in a Facebook group to being on this podcast to all the things that you do as an extraordinary educator consultant. So thank you so much for your work. We appreciate your time and having you on, and we hope that you have an incredible rest of your day.
Thank you all so much and be blessed.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening, literacy lovers. Be sure to visit our website to subscribe to our newsletter and podcast. It's literacypodcast.com.
Yep. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Most of them are at Literacy Podcast.
Yes. And please, please, please reach out to us. Melissa, what's our email address?
melissaandlori@literacypodcast.com is our email address. And we love getting emails from you all. And Lori and
I really read them.
Yeah, and we really respond. We love when you all reach out and we get to have conversations with you. So please email us.
Let us know what you're thinking, what you're thinking about literacy, what you're thinking about
ideas for us to podcast about.
Yes, ideas for podcasting, anything. We love to hear from you, what you liked, what you want.
Yeah,
we're here for you.
Mostly y'all are asking questions, which is great.
Yes.
We don't mind that either.
Yes. We're so glad you're here to learn with us.
Thank you, everybody.